From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the Ghostbuster gals join us as we lead you up into Halloween and our special Ghost to Ghost show on Wednesday. Here's what's happening. President Barack Obama has declared a major disaster area now in the New York City area as, of course, Superstorm Sandy pounded the Northeast, as you know by now. Looking at the aftermath, absolutely incredible, killing now at least 48 people, sweeping homes into the ocean, flooding large swaths of coastal areas, crippling public transit, leaving millions without power, 8.1 million homes. As the East Coast woke up, residents faced the prospect of up to a week without heat, light, or refrigeration, maybe even longer. Authorities tried to measure the full damage of the once-in-a-generation hurricane, as they say. Damage will probably exceed $20 billion. Dr. Tim Ball, a renowned environmental consultant, former professor of climatology at the University of Winnipeg. Tim, I want to thank you for coming on here to check in with us on this incredible story. Will we see this again?
Oh, of course we will. We've seen it in the past. It's a unique set of circumstances, but well, not unique, but it doesn't occur that often. But one of the things with this is you've got to keep it in perspective. We're not at the end of the hurricane season yet, but what's interesting about this hurricane is the path that it took, paralleling that coast. And of course, what hasn't been mentioned is that this was caused by the jet stream, which had pushed way down on the east central side of North America. And of course that pushed the hurricane, which by the way was gradually weakening. It actually got to a tropical storm at one point, and then it picked up a little bit again. But that combination of the cold air pushing south and the warm air pushing north is what created the problem. What's interesting about it, George, is that very low pressure in the center of that system, and a lot of people don't realize that air pushing down on the ocean keeps the ocean level down, and when there's low pressure, there's less pressure on, and the water rises up, literally swells up. And of course, with that low pressure, that meant you had a very large area of upwelling, and that, of course, moving north, and then the onshore winds, and if that coincided with a higher tide, and into the shallower water, because by the time you get up to New York City, you're into the continental shelf is wider there. So those combination of events are what created this situation.
And in this particular case, Tim, what brought the heavy flooding? Was it the winds from the hurricane or the rains from the hurricane?
Well, the rains certainly saturate the ground, and the rate at which rain falls, if it falls faster than the ground can absorb it, of course, the water itself creates an impervious layer. And you can see that in a very heavy thunderstorm.
Sure.
But the main thing here was, as I said, this surge of the combination of the onshore winds pushing the water on, the shallower water because of the shelf, the upwelling because of the low pressure. I've studied some of these things off the coast of Australia. It was very shallow, and very, very low pressure occurs. And it's sort of like a very, very long wave. Much, much longer even than a tsunami. And, of course, that just moving in on a coastline just keeps coming. And that's, of course, what caused most of the flooding problems.
Okay, Tim, thank you so much. And, of course, many people concerned about nuclear power plants and the possibility of them shutting down for three decades. Scott Portzlein of the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area has researched sabotage and terrorism of nuke power plants. Scott, were we in any danger at all because of this hurricane with our nuke plants?
Well, we were at risk. We weren't in any danger. We did okay, but there were some problems. Two of the plants were knocked offline. One happened when the winds blew a lightning arrestor off the power line into the line itself and shorted them out. That happened up in New York. One reactor was manually taken offline, and power was reduced at five others. In total, 13 nuclear reactors were affected by the storm so far. I'll tell you more about that in a minute. But right now, the hurricane is over two reactors near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And ironically, those two reactors at Beaver Valley are two of the only reactors on the East Coast, Northeast, that the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, did not send special inspectors in advance of the storm. And when I saw that last week, I thought that was a mistake, judging from the size of this superstorm.
Sure.
It turned out to be so. Well, the NRC, even as the storm approached today, did not send any additional inspectors to Beaver Valley. Right now, the threat is from loss of off-site power due to snow and ice that's happening there now. Yesterday, the highest concerns were at the two New Jersey reactors that you talked about, one at Oyster Creek, where they did have to declare an alert. Mm-hmm. Around 7 o'clock last night, they had flooding, and it was going to approach some of the systems that would cause them some trouble if it got into them. Now, the reactor itself was shut down, but the spent fuel pool was at risk. They saw that they needed to put a portable pump located in the vicinity of their spent fuel pool in case they needed backup cooling to that system. Well, they did that. They even had plans to use a fire hose to refill the spent fuel pools if it began to boil away. But then 2 hours later, at 9 o'clock, right at the peak of the storm surge, they lost off-site power. And the emergency diesel generators kicked in.
Oh, they're known to fail.
It happened at New York University Medical Center last night. Whitley reported on that. Shortly after that, the seawater actually went 5 inches higher than their flood level. And Oyster Creek had to declare an alert, which is the third highest level of emergency classification. But, George, we are lucky that no failure of that pump occurred.
Boy, we dodged a bullet on this one, Scott.
I think so. And you know, this is, even though this is called a superstorm, the winds weren't that high. The size of it was bad, and the results were bad. But if you ever saw photographs and videos from what happened at the Turkey Point nuclear plant in Hurricane Andrew, that would really make you rethink locating these in Hurricane Alley. Then another problem happened at the Salem, New Jersey plant, which is about 40 miles south of Philadelphia, where the storm surge turned up filthy water and carried debris into the intake structure, and they lost 4 of the 6 cooling pumps there. It's a secondary cooling pump. They ended up having to dump steam outside the plant through the atmospheric relief valves. There was probably a very small amount of radiation associated with that, nothing to be concerned with, I don't think.
Well, this is a wake-up call, Scott, and I hope that they get together and develop some real good plans in case this happens again. And as so many people have told us, it probably will. Thank you, Scott. Hurricane Sandy, while it was doing what it was doing to the east coast of the United States and Southeast Asia, they had their own problems with storms. At least 30 people dead in the Philippines and Vietnam. 200 people sickened from New Mexico's hazardous materials release there. Coming from an area along the Mexican border, they evacuated some of the people. A lot of people complaining of lightheadedness, nausea, and dizziness. A cold and wet summer across the United Kingdom has caused a dramatic fall in the amount of honey produced by British bees. According to a survey, their yields are down 72% compared to 2011. A New York City police officer has been charged with conspiring to kidnap, torture, cook and eat women whose names he listed in his computer. A Colombian mother has said that her one-month-old son is a devil who breathes fire and already has started walking. She's 28 years old, gave birth to her son last month, but says that her joy quickly turned to fear when she noticed that he had several abnormal behavior leading to fears in her community that he's the devil in disguise. The mother claimed that the boy can already stand up and walk. Quite a feat for a child of just 4 weeks old, much like the 1976 horror film The Omen. The mother said the baby frequently hides around the house, cackles like an adult for hours, and has an intimidating pair of eyes. Up next, Dr. Eben Alexander joins us. An incredible story, proof of heaven. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. For the next couple hours, you're going to hear an incredible story, a story we talked about several weeks ago. Dr. Eben Alexander, a renowned academic neurosurgeon, spent 54 years honing these scientific skills, world's view. He thought he knew how the brain and mind worked, but a near-death experience in which he was driven to the brink of death and spent a week deep in a coma with a brain infection changed all of that. He's written his book and his story, Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife, and he's with us right now. Dr. Evan Alexander. Evan, how are you?
I'm doing well, George. How about you?
Good. It's good to have you on. Did you ever expect this kind of notoriety after coming out with this story?
Well, I expected it would definitely have an impact, but it's far kind of outgrown very quickly what I thought would happen, at least at the introduction.
Our investigative reporter who's going to do a segment on you at the end of November, Linda Moulton Howe, said that she had a chance to interview you today.
Oh, yeah, we had a great talk.
All excited. She's a great reporter, and this is just, it's an incredible story. I want you to tell us what happened to you, the meningitis, and after that, let's talk a little bit about your belief system prior to this thing happening to you. But how did you get sick? What happened?
Well, it struck me like a freight train. I mean, out of the blue, this was 4:30 in the morning on November the 10th of 2008, just about 4 years ago, and I'd been very healthy and woke up that morning with severe back pain, and thought that maybe if I could get in a warm bath, that would help, and it only got worse, and then I could barely get back to the bed, and my wife was rubbing my back, trying to make me feel better, and that was not working. Then my son, Bond, who at that time was 10 years old, came in the room, realized I hadn't left for work yet, and he started rubbing my temples, and I realized I had a very severe headache. I mean, like he drove a white-hot railroad spike right through my head. And my last words to my wife were, don't call 911, you know, trust me, I'm a doctor, this is muscle spasm, and then I was gone for a week.
Well, and now let's go back. Prior to this episode occurring, and we're going to get into the things that happened to you when you were in this situation, in this coma, what was your belief system about life after death?
Well, I had grown up in a religious home in North Carolina. My father had been a combat surgeon in World War II in the Pacific, and I think his spirituality is what got him through that ordeal.
Yeah.
Went to a Methodist church, and I remember having what I thought were pretty healthy discussions with my Sunday school teachers around my scientific beliefs at that time. And really doubting that religious views of reality held much sway. But I would say for a lot of my, say, college life and after that, I thought maybe there could be a God and maybe there was some value to prayer. And then, of course, in the scientific world, academic neurosurgery, I spent more than 20 years working with patients and trying to understand how the brain works, but coming more and more to a conclusion that reductive science was the arbiter of truth and that the brain, to me, seemed to generate consciousness. And even though we didn't really know exactly how that happened, I figured it was only a matter of time, and sooner or later we would be able to understand how that occurred. And all of those beliefs, I will tell you, were completely destroyed and revised with my coma. Another thing to point out is that I go into this in detail in the book, and we could probably cover it tonight to some degree, but I was put up for adoption when I was a few weeks old.
Okay.
And adopted when I was 4 months old, and I looked for my birth mother some when I was younger, and she didn't seem to be out there in that North Carolina had very strict laws about anonymity. And she didn't seem to be looking for me. And so I kind of let it go. I just figured, okay, that's just the way it is. And,
sure.
You know, I can live with that. And then my oldest son, Eben, was doing a research project in school in the year 2000 that involved the family genealogy. And he rekindled my interest in trying to find my birth mother. And in fact, I did track her down at that point, at least enough to get a communication that it was not a good time to come back in her life. And that ended up really turning over my whole worldview of myself. I didn't realize how traumatic it was at the time, But I've since learned that, you know, getting a second rejection as an adult for an adoptee is a pretty severe blow.
And, it sure is.
It basically destroyed, for the 8 years before my coma, any belief in a loving personal God and any belief in power of prayer.
And was she able to tell you why she did what she did, or she just didn't want anything to...
Well, it was really... not a communication through her, and that was part of the problem. I came to understand it all much later, but what happened in 2000 was I found out over just a few minutes that not only had my birth parents gotten married, which was a very big surprise because all the indicators I had from 1954 were that they had gone their separate ways. They were high school lovers, and he was a senior, she was a sophomore, and all the information I had said that they had split up after she let go of me. But I found out that isn't the way it ended up. They ended up getting married, having three children, and in fact, my youngest sister had passed over in 1998, which was 2 years before I found all this out. And it was really because of that, and their grieving over her loss, that my birth sister, the other sister who was communicating with a children's home in North Carolina, said it's just not a good time to come back in their life.
Okay, so this entire belief system kept pushing you into, of course, not believing in life after death, probably not even believing that there was a God.
That's very true. I would say, especially after 2000. I mean, I think maybe I had what I'd call an Einsteinian view, where there was an omnipotent creator who we could not understand, but certainly not one who is a personal God with any interest in the lives of humans.
Did you have students or patients, Dr. Alexander, who ever talked with you about spirituality or life after death? Did that ever come up?
Well, there were definitely episodes of things that I would see in an ICU. I mean, in neurosurgery, there are a lot of very sick patients. I did a lot of work with malignant brain tumors. And I would see things when patients passed over, or I would hear things from family members, both at the time that a loved one passed over and also about later on about communications from loved ones who had made the transition. And I always believed that there would be a conventional explanation for those things, because the longer I spent in academic neurosurgery, the less I saw it possible that consciousness could survive the death of the brain and the body.
Okay, so the meningitis hits, you're in a coma. You've got to tell me medically, because I've got, God forbid that ever happens with me or anybody I know, but I mean, what's it like? Is it like a massive dream state? What happens to you?
Well, if you had asked me before my coma, you know, how much would a patient remember if they were driven deep into coma with a very severe bacterial meningitis that should have been fatal, and should have allowed absolutely no chance for neurologic recovery, of complete recovery, I would have told you they won't remember a single thing. And that was my assumption based on all my years of experience. And, of course, I wasn't asking people what they remembered. And I will say that probably about 15% of people who have a very severe medical challenge like that, that gives them a medical near-death situation, about 15% of those come back with very powerful and strange memories of that realm. And in medicine, we're just not in the habit of asking people to tell us about what they remember, because we generally don't think that they remember anything. And of course, they don't really volunteer it, because the memories can be so bizarre that they're worried that they'll be labeled crazy or something like that.
Well, that's right. Evan, stay with us. We're going to take this very quick break, and we're going to come right back. We're talking with Dr. Evan Alexander, his work, Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife, and what a journey it was. We'll talk more with him about that when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Eben Alexander with us, Proof of Heaven. So, Eben, when you were in this coma state and things are going on, at what point then when you come out of it do you realize something strange happened here?
Well, I can tell you that what I do remember, and I said a minute ago that I wouldn't expect a patient to remember anything, my initial awareness inside of coma was of a very kind of murky, kind of underground, bubbling mud. I had absolutely no memory whatsoever of my life on Earth before. No identity, no knowledge of humans or Earth or this universe. All my words, all language completely deleted by the meningitis. I mean, my cortex had been wiped out. And what I remember was this very long period of kind of this murky, very difficult to, you know, see or appreciate anything, a sense of roots around me or vessels, and very dark and monotonous pounding sounds. And that's the way it was for a very long time. Given that I had no memory of my life before, time there seemed to stretch into eons. And it was from that that I was actually rescued by this spinning, very fine and bright white light that had a melody with it, a beautiful, beautiful melody that was gorgeous music compared to the pounding monotony that I'd had for eons in that underground earthworm eye view realm, as I called it. And this white spinning light opened up into a lovely valley, very verdant, fertile, flowers blossoming and buds blooming, and I was a speck of awareness on a butterfly wing with all of these millions of colorful butterflies all around, pools of water, sparkling waterfalls, and up above these arcs of light that were giving these chants and hymns with crescendos. And I mean, it was a very beautiful scene. It had trappings of kind of our earthly existence, like the butterflies and flowers and what I called peasants, which I think were souls down below us dancing, and a beautiful girl on the butterfly wing beside me. And of course, a lot of people hear these kind of descriptions and they say, well, how can that be heaven? It's very earthly. And it turns out it's a gateway that took me to an outer realm. And it was in this gateway realm where I became aware, as a warm summer breeze blew through, of the divine creative power beneath it all, behind all of this scene and all of creation. And then this sense of incredible loving coming from the girl on the butterfly wing, that I was deeply loved and cherished, that I could do no wrong, and that when I say that, and I say that in the book, it means do no wrong in that realm, in the heavenly spiritual realm, not to suggest that we can do no wrong in the earthly realm, because we certainly can, and that I was cherished and had nothing to fear. And from that point, we went out of this universe. I remember seeing all of the higher dimensional space and time contracting down, and then being out in this infinite coal black void that was filled with that love, and also had this brilliant orb of light beside me. And there was this awareness of the three of us, of that divine, infinitely knowing and loving creative source, who many would call God, and then this brilliant orb of light, and then my consciousness, which was far beyond the consciousness of any individual. In fact, of all of humanity, this was eternal consciousness. And I was told, not in words, but in concepts, that they would show me many things, but that I would be going back. And in fact, they did show many things about love as the fabric of all, and the physical makeup of the universe, the necessity for evil, the role of free will. I mean, there were many lessons, and I was then tumbled back into that earthworm eye view, the very primitive starting place. And I learned that by remembering the notes, the melody, I could bring that melody back in the spinning white light, and that took me back into that perfectly beautiful gateway. And the shocking thing was how ultra real that gateway and the core, that infinite darkness with the divine spirit and with the orb of light, those very ultra real realms compared to that coarse monotony of the earth were my view. And I would cycle through time after time after time, going from that coarse realm, which I think was the best consciousness that my brain soaking in pus could muster, and the brilliant, beautiful ultra reality, very vivid, auditory and visual and experience all completely intermixed, at times becoming the entire scene was how it was taught. And it really was a stunning experience, especially when I had a severe meningitis that had wiped out my neocortex.
Sure. What was it, Evan, that made you think that this could very well be the other side instead of some kind of abnormality of the brain?
Well, when I was first waking up from all this, on the seventh day, I still had the ventilator tube in, and it shocked everyone. My doctors at best expected I would spend 3 months at the hospital and then need chronic care in a nursing home. And when all of a sudden I started to wake up on the seventh day, they were very surprised. And at that time when I was waking up, I really had still no memory of my earthly life. And even though family members were around me in the room in the ICU, it was very difficult to recognize anybody because all my memories were gone. But I did remember everything about that journey deep in coma. And it was an extraordinary journey that actually, as I sat down to write it up in my recovery phase after I got out of the hospital, took me about 6 weeks and was 20,000 words. I mean, it was a very complex story, of tremendous amount of lessons that I learned, and some of that I convey in the current book. A lot of it is still knowledge that comes to me in meditation. I mean, as people often say about near-death experiences, you can spend the rest of your life kind of bringing down the lessons that you picked up there, because it doesn't all come back in this easy form to interpret, because it's so foreign to our earthly existence and our earthly language.
It's a remarkable situation. I'm going to get deep into this with you, Evan. Quick question on comas then. Ariel Sharon, he's been in a coma almost 7 years. How long can you stay alive like this?
Well, patients can exist in a coma for a very long time, for years and years. It's a very kind of strange question. It's a territory that we don't really understand very well. We do think that some patients do gain some awareness in a coma, but in general, I think the kind of general neurosurgical, neuroscientific conception is that there is no real awareness going on. Even though the patients will often appear over time, they start to manifest behaviors called coma vigil, where they will look around and open their eyes and go through what appear to be kind of sleep-wake cycles. It's very rare that you can document that there seems to be much awareness there. There are some notable exceptions to that, and certainly some EEG studies and things like that that occasionally show that maybe people do have some awareness while in a deep coma. But as a general rule, and especially with a severe meningitis like I had, you don't expect any kind of experience at all. And in fact, even if you were to assume that maybe they had some kind of experience, how that would be laid down in memory basically seems to be impossible, because all of our thinking about memory, at least my prior thinking, had to do with memory, the anatomy and kind of the biochemistry and molecular biology of memory formation in the brain. And there are certain steps that we know are important, but I would say that neuroscience is a very long way from really understanding how memory works at all. And I now believe that a lot of memory is actually associated with processes that are outside of the physical brain and physical universe.
If this exists, and I believe it does, what do you think it is? What's out there on the other side?
Oh, well, for me, it has become very clear in analyzing this, and I think I should preface this by saying that, you know, as my language and then family memories and then neuroscientific memories started coming back in the days and weeks coming out of coma, I was absolutely blown away by the power of the experience. It was too real to be real. And yet, discussions with my doctors and also with my oldest son, Evan, who was majoring in neuroscience, just days after I got out of the hospital, indicated to me that I should be writing it up as a neuroscientific report. I mean, that there was no intention there to report this to the world as some grand revelation, because I was shocked by the ultra reality, but I figured there had to be some kind of a neuroscientific brain-based explanation. And I took my son's advice. He said, write everything down. Don't read anything about near-death experiences. Don't read anything about physics or cosmology. Just write down your experience. Don't talk to anybody who was there. And that's why I spent 6 weeks writing it down. I didn't read anything about near-death experience until after it was all recorded. I had those 20,000 words. And then started looking into the near-death literature and was shocked to find out the similarities to my experience, and especially some of the descriptions of ultra reality and of meeting that awesome, beyond description, creative, loving source of it all. In fact, I did not even use the word God for months. I didn't feel comfortable putting any word on that awesome power, because it was just beyond any description, beyond any visual image at all. And it over time, I became aware of the power of what my story was really telling me, that it was far beyond trying to come up with a neuroscientific explanation. In fact, I had 9 such hypotheses based on what I saw as the kind of refutations of the near-death experiences that you often find in the medical and the scientific literature. And yet, because I had a severe meningitis, I mean, so severe that I rapidly went into coma. Within 3 or 4 hours, I was in coma. And if you have bacterial meningitis and go into coma within 24 hours, you're already down to a 10% survival probability when you hit the emergency room. And, of course, I went into coma much more quickly.
Yeah.
And then I did not respond to antibiotics initially and did not show any neurologic improvement really until the 6th day of coma. And most patients with severe bacterial meningitis who go into coma quickly, they're either dead by the 2nd or 3rd day or they're starting to wake up. But to still be in coma is a very bad sign. So by the end of the week, my survival chance was down to probably 2 or 3%. And my doctors were saying that my chance of any kind of major neurologic recovery were zero. There was just no way that I should be able to come back. The CT scan showed a global meningitis all over the surface of my brain. And there really should have been no possibility for experiencing anything. And that's why people who say, oh, it must have been a dream or hallucination or a DMT experience. Well, all of those things necessitate at least some part of the neocortex to be functioning. And because of the anatomic organization of the neocortex and how it works as the most powerful calculator in the brain, that's where we put all of consciousness together. That outer surface, the neocortex, is where language and kind of consciousness, being aware of surroundings, visual, auditory, sense of body, sense of, you know, what's around you, all of that is put together in the neocortex. And when the neocortex is soaking in pus for 7 days, to the point where another lab value that shows how intense this was, normally the glucose level, the sugar level in the fluid around the brain is around 60 to 80. And in a very bad case, bacterial meningitis, that might drop down to about 20. And in my case, the glucose level went all the way down to 1.
Gosh, you were like the walking dead, but you weren't walking.
No, I wasn't doing any walking. In fact, I not only had severe cortical damage, but from early on, my brainstem was also damaged. And my eye movements, things like that. I did not have any of the normal reflexes that people have if they still are having reasonable brain function. So I was extremely sick from this. And as I uncovered all that in the weeks after my coma, I realized I should not have had any experience whatsoever.
No, not at all. When you came back,
uh-huh.
Did you want to come back or did you want to go back to the other side?
Well, that's a very good question. I can tell you that when I was deep in this experience, every time I went through that gateway and out into the core, which was that infinite blackness with that loving deity and the entire multiverse collapsed in front of me in that brilliant orb of light, I was always told in concept that I would be taught many things but was not there to stay. And I really never recall making any decision about it. Now, it's important to understand that all of my life memories had been deleted, and that's kind of atypical for a near-death experience, but I think in a sense, it's a part of my near-death experience that makes it so valuable. And it has to do with the fact that I was completely detached from my prior earthly existence, and this allowed me to have a very deep, very transcendental experience where I was taught many things, and it was intended that I would be bringing those things back.
How has this experience changed you?
I would say it's changed everything. It's changed everything about how I view the world. I now, as I said, I went through all those years thinking the brain makes consciousness and mind and soul mm-hmm. and spirit, and now realize that it works completely the opposite, that soul and spirit are eternal. And that the brain, the way I put it now, is we are conscious in spite of our brain. That, in fact, the brain is mainly serving as a reducing valve or a filter. And it has a veiling function. And that's part of why when people come back from near-death experiences, that gateway region is kind of tainted by their personal and cultural background. And that's what gives them, some kind of earthly trappings in their reporting of that heavenly realm. But in fact, the deepest part of it, that infinite darkness of the core with the divine deity and the orb and all the knowing about our higher existence of this entire universe, that kind of thing, although it's extremely difficult to explain and to bring back to the earthly realm, there is every bit of the knowing of the eternity of that and of the depth of it far beyond our human knowledge and our human capabilities. And yet it's the root of all consciousness, that really our consciousness is a divine link that we all share one with each other, because at the deepest conscious levels, the boundaries between us disappear. But also it's a direct linkage to that divine creative source of all.
Absolutely remarkable journey, Evan, that you have taken. We're going to take this quick break, and we're going to come back in a moment. We're going to take phone calls and continue talking with you. I definitely want to get your views on whether you think hell exists, for example, and what people can do if they experience all of this. Dr. Evan Alexander, our guest, his book, Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. lifebeyonddeath.net. That's what it is. If you're out there driving around and you just want to remember it, we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.